Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to your weekly news show about Africa with briefings and analysis from the continent. Amandla has been on the air now for over 30 years, and we're very pleased to be able to keep going in this time of COVID and bringing you more news and more information and more analysis about what's happening on the continent. This week, Gwen, what have we got going? Rashid, Firoz has once again pulled another one of his brilliant coups here.
Okay, yes. So, yes, we're going to be taking a look at a book that Diraja Press just published in collaboration with the Transnational Institute called The Region in Revolt, Mapping the Recent Uprisings in North Africa and West Asia. So we'll be bringing some of the voices that contributed to that book to the air tonight.
That's great. Thanks a lot. So stay tuned to Amandla.
Welcome back to Amandla here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, CKUT.ca around the world. And for the best of Amandla, please check out our blog, which is at amandla.ca. So yes, tonight we're going to be taking a look at a book called A Region in Revolt, Mapping the Recent Uprisings in North Africa and West Asia, a collection of essays edited by Jade Saab. The book is published by Diraja Press and the Transnational Institute and explores the second wave of protests that washed over North Africa and West Asia last year, with a focus on popular struggles in Sudan, Algeria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Iran from the people's perspective. The book looks at what these post-Arab Spring movements have in common in terms of opposing authoritarian regimes and deteriorating economic situations and their demands for radical change in social relations, but is careful to root each in the specifics of historical, political, and economic context. A few weeks back, there was an online roundtable discussion on the book hosted by Firoz Manji, the publisher of Diraja Press and a good friend of us here at Amandla. So tonight, Doug kindly is bringing us excerpts of that discussion with Sarah Abbas, who's a doctoral candidate in political science at the Freie Universität Berlin on Sudan, and French Algerian Sarah Oumari, who is a member of the new anti-capitalist party on Algeria.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. This is Firoz Manji from Diraja Press. Welcome to the launch of A Region in Revolt, Mapping the Recent Uprisings in North Africa and West Asia. This is a recently published book and has already had people write wonderful recommendations on it. Let me quickly introduce the people who will be speaking today. The editor of this book is Jade Saab, who wrote on Lebanon as well, and he is a Lebanese Canadian writer and activist. We have Sarah Abbas from Sudan, doing a doctoral as a doctoral candidate in political science at the Free University of Berlin. Selma Omari from Algeria, French Algerian, a member of the new anti-capitalist party. I'm sure there'll be a lot of interest in learning what the new anti-capitalist party is all about. Zeydon Al-Kanani will be speaking about Iraq, independent Iraqi Swedish political researcher and analyst specializing in geopolitics. We will have Joey Ayoub, who will be the main speaker on the Lebanon chapter. He is a Lebanese Palestinian scholar, activist, and writer. And finally, we will have Freda Efari talking about Iran. She's a librarian, translator, producer of the Iranian Progressives in Translation, and co-founder of the Alliance of Middle Eastern and North African Socialists. And I think that's quite an important thing to mention, because I think this book has its origins in the discussions within that alliance. Jade Saab, let's start with you. Why did you think it was necessary to produce this book? What was behind it?
Thanks for that, Feroz. It was quite a bit of a journey, actually, and it started before the idea of the book. There was the Lebanese uprising, which we write about in the book, and that led me on to searching out people with similar viewpoints or similar ideas on what is happening in the region as a whole. Lebanon was the third, if not the fourth, in a series of new uprisings in the region. So I was seeking out voices, who are covering events in other countries to get a more regional perspective of what was happening. Through that, by happenstance, I stumbled across the Alliance of Middle Eastern and North African Socialists. I had a chat with Frida and just started to familiarize myself with the works of the network. And I realized that this is just a great opportunity to bring people together to write about this in a timely manner as it was still unfolding at the time. So that's kind of the narrative aspect of how this project came to be. The other one was bringing a perspective that is quite different as to how the first wave of protests were covered back in 2010 and 2011, and bringing in really focusing on the movements themselves. What are their aspirations? What are their limitations? And analyzing them beyond kind of the coverage we had before on, the role of social media, or breaking it down to simple things that made it seem that these uprisings are ahistorical or spontaneous. So we wanted to give every country its due in terms of the history of its struggles, as well as the movements on the ground and what their possibilities and potentials are.
How did you avoid what is so common in these books about these struggles? Is that Orientalist lens? How did you conceive of avoiding that trap?
Yeah, that's definitely a big one. And I think, we have to give credit here to all the writers. I mean, that's what makes this, the work that it is. All of us are very active in the regions and the countries we've written about. So we have that, insight to begin with. And the second is letting the movements speak for themselves. By giving this long view historical analysis at the beginning of each chapter or each section of the book, you allow people to see the complexity within each country and the history and the struggles of each country. You give it life in a sense. And then by focusing on the main actors of the movement, as opposed to geopolitics, which is something that the region is many times reduced to as power struggles between East and West and that kind of lens, just giving the space for the movements themselves, for the different actors, be it labor, be it women's struggles, be it minorities. So giving that depth in a accessible way still is the way I think we were able to avoid that.
I'd like to move on to asking Sara Abbas perhaps to take us through a country in which enormous things have happened, enormous developments and quite extraordinary developments, but yet there seems to be a blind spot in the media, and indeed on the left, I would say, about what I find in your description, extraordinarily exciting evolution of a struggle that we could not even have dreamt of a few years ago. And so I wonder if you'd like to help us understand that perspective.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm actually was very happy to be part of this project because one of the problems of the last 30 years of the al-Bashir regime was this kind of isolation that was imposed by the regime on the Sudanese, but also by sanctions from the US, from the West on the country. So kind of this dual move of the isolation of the regime itself and the sanctions, which have made it very, which have largely isolated us from much of the rest of the world and from the region. And I saw some similar dynamics as well in Frida's chapter, so I always find it quite interesting to read about Iran. I think it's very interesting, actually, and one of the things that drew me to this project was the long view. Because as you mentioned, Firoz, that region, as well as much of sub-Saharan Africa, is thought of as a kind of this place without a history, right? This colonial idea continues to persist. And I would say furthermore, in my discipline at least, which is political science, the Arab Spring or the so-called Arab Spring was treated as kind of like the beginning of history. And this was unfortunately internalized by a lot of analysts within the region itself. And of course, that boils down to this idea that peoples of those regions do this kind of dominant idea, this Orientalist lens that you mentioned, that they like authoritarianism. They don't know how to live or be governed without it. So I see a massive move and a massive change between then to now in the ways that we approach these movements. So when it comes to Sudan, I don't know how much I can shed light on it, but I think it's, you know, I really hope that people read this book. Sudan, of course, something that is not very well known about it is that it has a very, very rich history of civil uprisings. So actually, the revolution in Tunisia and in Egypt was not as much of an earthquake in Sudan as it was elsewhere, partly because the Sudanese had seen these mass movements take down authoritarian regimes, specifically military dictatorships, both in 1964 and 1985. But of course, that set in motion regional dynamics that had also an influence many years later on the revolution that began in December 2018. And I think it's very interesting that this wave began in Sudan. I mean, Sudan is somewhat marginal to the region. It's a Black African nation that sits between these two kind of colonially constructed regions, the North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa. The elites, whether civilian or military, have always tried to promote, if not impose at moments, brutally Arab identity, but it still remains kind of marginal to the region. So I think what we try, Azza Mustafa and I, Azza Mustafa is the co-author, political scientist based in Sudan, what we try to do in this chapter is to really show the buildup of social movement work that resulted in what we would argue is one of the most sophisticated forms of organizing and mobilizing of social movements in this century. There has been a real high level of grassroots organizing and mobilizing that allowed these protests. There have been protests for many years in Sudan, but that have allowed these sparks to actually turn into this sustained resistance to the regime. At the same time, we want to be very careful for Sudan not to become the Tunisia of the second wave, meaning there has been a lot of analysis paid to the so-called failures of the first wave of uprisings. And of course, in this book, we reject this binary of success and failure. But Tunisia has always been posited as the success story, but we know that many of the demands of that revolution have not been actually fulfilled. And so what we also try to go through in this chapter, or at least reflect on in the conclusions, of course, is very early, but how is it that the counter-revolution actually works to attempt to dismantle even such a sophisticated level of organizing in Sudan, which worked at multiple levels between the trade unions, the Sudan Professionals Association, but also the grassroots resistance committees. I'm not going to go on much further because I know I only have 5 minutes, but I think it would be also interesting for us to not only try to draw the connections between the different chapters, which is, I think, what the real strength of this book is, but also to reflect slightly on some of the issues that we pick up on in the book, but perhaps are even more relevant now, which is speaking, for example, about the impact of COVID on this. And then for us, particularly in Sudan, as we see playing out right now, is the role of the international counter-revolutionary factors. So we try also in this book to break out of the idea of only analyzing the sort of local and national conditions, but really look at this very complex interplay between different, not just different levels of the revolution, but different levels of the counter-revolution as well.
I think that's really important. I think it's one of the strengths of each of the chapters in this book, and I think in particular in yours, it reminds me of Cabral's caution that, you know, it's not enough to just blame imperialism, and he says we have to remember that rice only cooks inside the pot, and so I think it is something important. I think your chapter helps enormously in understanding those movements and what is erupting, but I in my head I can't resolve the recent signature between Israel, the Zionist Israel, and the Sudanese regime. I mean, can you help me understand, in the context of all this enormous uprisings, incredible creativity, how is that possible?
Well, I'll give you my take on it. This is actually quite a contentious, as you can imagine, contentious topic, and some of us are also trying to wrap our heads around it. But one of the problems of the ways in which the al-Bashir regime functioned was that, and this we can see actually in the other chapters in the other countries as well, is the way that these regimes have attacked the international community, and by international community I mean the West. So much was blamed on foreign agendas, Zionist agendas, and so forth. And I think while the Sudanese historically have always stood had been very steadfast on the issue of the Palestinian cause, what has happened is that one of the problems is that it has been set up almost that you have there's been this narrative that our welcoming back into the international community is going to resolve at least the economic crisis. And of course, the economic crisis has massively deepened in the last, I mean, it's always difficult to talk about economics in Sudan because every time you think you've hit the bottom of the barrel falls out. And so the economic issue was one of the massive, biggest sparks for the revolution itself. So in the beginning, in the international media, the protests were reported as bread riots, right? So generally anything in relation to people of color or Black people or Africans is reported as riots, right? It's a way of kind of depoliticizing these movements. But the fact of the matter is, in response, there has been also a move to kind of downplay the economic factors, which are massive in Sudan. And it, the narrative that has been spun by the Sudanese elite, and I'm talking here civilian and military alike, has been that should we manage to remove sanctions on Sudan, which were partially removed already, but also if we manage to get out of this U.S. state sponsors of terrorism list of, on which we have been since the 1990s, that somehow this will alleviate the economic crisis, which has reached really quite desperate levels. And so there has been this belief, or this, let's say there was a campaign that started a few months ago to promote the idea that we have to remove ourselves from this list at any cost. And of course, the cost has been quite high. Not to mention, in my humble opinion, it sets a very bad precedent. One of it is that we've paid hundreds of millions of dollars to the U.S. in compensation for the victims of the U.S. USS Cole attack, as well as the victims of the embassy bombings in Tanzania and Kenya, the U.S. embassy bombings. So this one of the poorest countries in the world is paying one of the richest countries hundreds of millions of dollars, right, at a time of deep economic crisis. And on top of it, the U.S. threw into this deal the fact that you would have to also normalize relations with Israel. Now, the U.S. is not the only player. In the Sudanese revolution, during the actual uprising and since, the role of Saudi Arabia and the UAE has been pivotal in the counter-revolution, and that continues. The military leadership within the government is very, very close to the UAE in particular, both to the UAE and Saudi Arabia. And of course, the UAE was normalizing relations with Israel. Now, the issue itself, the people who are against this normalization within Sudanese civil society are often accused of elitism, which has been one of the things that has been part of this coordinated campaign for normalization. But also, many people are questioning not necessarily the choice itself, but the fact that this unelected government, which to this day has not appointed a transitional legislative assembly, which is a key component of this transitional period, is making decisions on this. So internationally, for Israel, it's not just a question of legitimization. It's also a very important question in relation to its own internal politics, because Darfurian refugees, or refugees from the region of Darfur in Sudan, but also from other parts of Sudan, are one of the biggest groups of refugees in Israel, and have been treated really, really, really in brutal ways. And this is well documented by human rights organizations within Israel itself. And so Israel's interest in this is also for it to be able to get rid of what it calls its infiltrator problems, because they're not called refugees, they're called infiltrators. So you see this kind of, I would say, the coming together of the Sudanese elite, both the civilian and the military, along with these international agendas in relation to the legitimization of Israel, but also the UAE's influence over the military. And that's how you end up with this decision. In theory, the decision is not formalized yet. The upcoming assembly would formalize it, but the government is already acting in this as though the normalization is law. So I would say that it is a done deal unless something happens between now and when this legislative assembly would vote on it.
Let's turn to Algeria. You know, people of my generation cut their teeth in the Algerian revolution. And to see it arising again, but the creativity of the recent uprising has been quite extraordinary. So let me turn to Salma Omari. Perhaps you can help us understand the nature of this extraordinary uprising.
Yes, sure. Thank you for the invitation. Just to precise, I currently live in Paris. The New Anti-Capitalist Party is an organization who is in France. So what's the relationship with Algeria? You might know it a bit, but The organization's history has been committed to fight for the liberation also of Algeria under the colonialist rule. So there is this always this relationship of solidarity and struggle from France to Algeria. And this is the history in which many people here, Algerians living in France, are still in. So concerning the Hirak itself, actually, the first thing I would like to acknowledge is that the Sudanese, in the timing, the Sudanese rise up and also showed the way to the Algerians who started their Hirak. Now that we can see that we live in a world with mass uprising, it's very important to document them, to show the history where it comes from, and to understand what's happening today in Algeria, what brought the people to protest against the regime, to denounce the military regime, is also the result of a long history of struggles that very few people know, very few people have informations from everything that happened since the independence, and that's what the chapter is about. Unity between the class needed to be built on a long-term basis. We show that many social movements, many trade union movements and strikes as well, cultural also, discussions about what it means to be Algerian, because we had a history of this, and it had divided Algerians for a long time between the Amazigh, the original culture, the Amazigh identity, and the Arab identity, and the French heritage. So all this shows that the identity is very complex, and it was a very important element in which I would say that people had lots of fights. There were, like, the state actually tried to bind and censor the Amazigh identity since the independence, just to assert that Algeria is an Arab country, which is not just that. I think the same thing that Sudan is experiencing, and so we've been beyond that, and this is what also allowed more unity among the people to face also their, I would say, their oppressors, and that's an important element. So in the chapter, you have the cultural side, but you also have the economic situation. And I think the goal with Hamza Hamouchen, who contributed to the article, is not just to explain the internal economic situation, but to understand the internal economic situation and the crisis Algeria is witnessing, the economic crisis Algeria is witnessing. You have to link it with the way the global economy is organized and the role of Algeria within it, and especially the choice of the ruling class to submit to the international economical rules of the market, which means providing, providing oil and gas roughly in low prices, was the main economic activity, and it is submitted to the global economy as well as many other aspects of it. So the question of what do we do with our natural resources is was key, and linked to that also It's not just an economic question, as we see. It's a balance of forces globally, but also internally, and even the revenues of the oil and gas is, I would say, just taking over by the ruling class, which is mostly composed by the military. Just to say it roughly. And the whole question of national sovereignty over these resources is also raised. And it is a very sensitive question in Algeria. And it was an important motto in the massive Hirak movement that we have witnessed, because it dwells in a long history of resisting colonialism. And in a way, after the independence, it has been translated, especially within this movement, into what I would say a reappropriation of a common power over the state. So this is the way that we, in the chapter, this is the way we mostly try to explain how we came to a situation in which such a movement was erupted, such massive demonstration all throughout the country erupted, and also the halting since the COVID crisis, which actually put a momentum to the movement. But still, we don't know what's happening, because as we said also in the chapter, there are resistance within the movement, because the military is now banning and imprisoning journalists, activists, and so there are also movements to oppose that. Until now, it is the kind of tension that is happening, because they are trying to profit from the COVID crisis to censor and imprison the people.
Perhaps we could turn to discussing the situation in Iraq. Zaidan Al-Kinani, would you be up for giving us a quick update on that?
Sure. Thank you, Feroz. Thank you, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here with everyone. We just met today online for the first time. Well, at least I did. Before I move locally into speaking about the Iraq case that I was responsible for in this book, I would like to talk about the regional commonality, since we're talking about the MENA protest movements. And one of the most interesting things that I realized and observed personally before we even started this book is that the second wave of the MENA protest, or the second wave of the Arab Spring, like a lot of people would like to call, but it doesn't really have that notion for many reasons, is that we witnessed that the protest movements in this book did skip or try to avoid the mistakes or the unfortunate challenges that a lot of the uprisings had to fall into, or the traps they had to fall into during the Arab Spring. There was a lot of awareness. There was a lot of youth awareness and momentum regarding to ensure that no political agendas would be able to take an advantage of an empty platform that is led by a grassroots youth-led protest movement. There was a lot of awareness about avoiding any sort of political discourse that would promote or encourage moving from a peaceful uprising to an armed rebellion. Although a lot of the uprisings in the MENA region fell into that without the actual protest movement welcoming it. There was a lot of care from the regional power players. They weren't as keen in getting involved or interfering, just like they used to in the Arab Spring. Maybe they did so more in Iraq than the other protests in this book. I also like to look at the similarities between some of the countries. Lebanon and Iraq shared a very similar challenge that both protest movements were rising against, and that is the muhasasa, which is known as the ethnic sectarian quota that was imposed on the people, where they distribute or share the powerful positions and ministries to political parties based on their ethnic sectarian distribution or division instead of their experience or qualifications to have those positions. Iraq was also a victim of the Iran-backed militias that are in Iraq and that are the armed wings of the most powerful political parties in government. Those are the very same Iran-backed militias that were targeting and killing and assassinating and intimidating the protesters in Iran. So you can see a lot of similarities between two different nations that have probably a very different struggle, but it's also very similar at the same time. Iraq and Algeria, I would say the main similarity would be that card that the government always use about the public fear of religious fundamentalism coming up if we lose the army or if we lose the government, and that if the Algerian government or the system or the police force loses control over Algeria, if the same thing happens in Iraq, then we have all these extremist groups that are going to take over Iraq, and ignoring the thousands of academics and scholars and activists and public servants that could build a better future for both countries. And I guess that's the similarities.
What about you, Selma? I saw you shaking your head in relation to...
Yes, that's it. I was really inspired by the similarities between Iraq and Algeria, but I would like also to acknowledge the fact that the way you fought against sectarianism is also very inspiring for us, because Algeria is known mostly as Sunni in majority, Muslim Sunni, and it seems that, you know, from outside that we don't have issue between us, but actually we do have. And in the definition also of Algerian nationalities, as a result of colonialism, you have the fact that we are automatically Muslims. So the question of religious freedom, even within Islam, is raised. And we still have in Algeria lots to learn about religious freedom and stand in solidarity with people who, you know, just want to define themselves the way they are. And it's a kind of, you know... Despite the fact that it's not really written in the law, not as clearly as in Iraq or even in Lebanon, still you have this issue that needs to come out, especially because more and more migrants are living in Algeria, and so you have also this especially anti-Black racism. And one of the elements of the anti-Black racism is also based on religious hatred. So that's why we need to understand that it's not because you live in a country with his supposed to be historically Muslims that you reject all parts, all differences, all different religious trends that actually exist, but some of them, you know, are hidden, like Christians still in Algeria are, you know, very oppressed, very especially by the controlled by the state, and so there is no clear, even in the movement we still not have this clear expression of that. So yeah. I think that's why the articles on Lebanon and potential concerning Sudan, I as we said in the article, we really need to learn on how we need to self-organize ourselves, because the Hirak was a kind of spontaneous movement, but it was structured around weekly demonstration, and it had to halt because of the COVID. But how do you also manage to build more a stronger trade union organization, even political organizations? Still, there are political organizations in Algeria that are trying to structure, but it's still too weak. And so the role of organization within a revolution is key if you want to achieve something. And the case of Sudan shows that without these structures, as well as the movement, we can't get anything. We can't make the process going further and the stakes getting higher if we don't build such organization. So I believe we are all in a moment in which we really need to I would say support every attempt in all these countries to get better organization, and And it's also a question that is crossed all throughout this chapter, whether it's about Iraq, whether it's about Lebanon, whether there also it's about Sudan, what type of organizations do we need, and what organization can we concretely support and materially, but also politically, for those who are imprisoned. And the experience also of in Iran on the fight on fighting for the liberation of political prisoners is important, because this phenomenon in Algeria is getting worse. So we need to also see how Iranians manage to bring up, you know, international campaigns to liberate political prisoners.
Over the last 9 months, as we have survived the pandemic here in Canada, Africa too has been experiencing it in so many different ways. And we've covered that quite broadly from top to bottom, north to south, center to out. And they too bring it up as a part of the issues facing the popular struggle, and not always with effective results.
Again, you know, most of the ruling classes in the regions covered in this book don't have the healthcare and don't care to provide the healthcare for people. And we have seen it acting as a radicalizing element, at the same time acting as a justification to bring in the army. For the example of Lebanon, the army was mobilized to impose lockdown and to suppress the movements themselves. It's hard to say, maybe after this, there will be a reinvigoration, a more radical street movement that adds to its list of things the government has messed up, essentially, the response to COVID. But so far, I'd say COVID has tipped the balance in favor of the ruling classes who have been able to mobilize against the street.
Sarah, do you see the same manifestation in Sudan?
One thing that has happened under this transitional government, or what we call the civilian component of this transitional government, is they've responded to demands to increase spending on health, education, particularly these two. I mean, Sudan is a country that under the former regime, at least 70 to 75% of its budget went to defense and security, right? So if you look at the new budget, it's much better in the sense that they've increased, on paper, they've increased spending. The problem is that actually the Sudanese Minister of Health, who has lost his job since, was heavily critiqued at the beginning of the pandemic for going on TV and saying, look, if you don't observe the lockdowns and if you don't prevent yourself from being infected, the best we can do for you, and maybe not even that, is to put you give you some oxygen, but there's nothing we can do for you. And that was a really interesting moment, because what actually infuriated the elites was not the problem itself, but the fact that he spoke about it openly, okay? And it sort of boils, I mean, there was more a rage that he sort of made the country look bad than the fact that there is such a situation going on in the country where your Minister of Health is telling you that basically you're gonna die if you get COVID. But the interesting thing is that this transitional period, some effort has been made at legal reform, I would say very progressive legal reform. Some effort has been made at changing the budget, so rebudgeting, reallocating budget. The problem is there has been very little effort made to actually address the economic structure. And the economic structure remains such, I mean, I think about Algeria, also the chapter on Algeria, this extractive relationship that we have with our resources, number one. So what do we supply? We still supply only raw materials to the rest of the world. Secondly, most of this, for example, one of the biggest sources since the loss of the oil revenues in 2011, or much of the oil revenues to South Sudan, the regime, the al-Bashir regime, was saved temporarily by the emergence of gold. Sudan has some of the biggest gold deposits in the world. And these gold deposits remain under the control of the Rapid Support Forces militia, the Janjaweed militia that's now part of the governance. It is under the control of, I don't know, 50, 80. People are still trying to map the amount of companies or front companies that own these mines. There have been mass sit-ins across the country in different places since the transition, right? Since the beginning of the transition, where people have demanded that they gain control over these resources, or that at least the government would strip these resources away. So you ended up, for example, with the lockdown situation. I'm in touch with the Union of Tea and Food Sellers, which are some of the most marginalized women in the urban areas who are displaced by war from Darfur, from Blue Nile, from Nuba Mountains, some of the richest areas of the countries in terms of resources and the poorest in terms of the population, and who are also racialized, right? They are non-Arabs and racialized within that matrix. And there was an attempt to impose the lockdown on them with absolutely no provision whatsoever for their well-being, or for the fact that if these women do not go to the market or on the street, they cannot actually earn and survive, right? So for much of the poor, COVID itself has not been the biggest problem. The biggest problem is, how do we eat? I mean, there's less of a concern about catching it and more of a concern about the fact that the ways that it's changed the economic landscape has made it even more impossible to survive economically. It has also been interesting because the very elites usually do not get medical treatment in the country. They go elsewhere. Jordan, Egypt, the very wealthy go to the UK. And it's been really interesting for them, because unless you own a dual passport, this is the first time in which they have not been able to get on a plane and go. And so that has also kind of been interesting to watch, this kind of paralysis of, my God, we have to use this health system, you know, this same health system, even though you have layers of it. But even the best private hospitals in Sudan are in many ways death traps, right? There's a saying in Sudan that if you're ill and you go into a hospital, you will probably die. And if you're okay, you will get ill. So for the first time, many of them have had to actually face this issue. So I think the budgetary allocations are a good move. But at the same time, if there is no real attempt to challenge the structure of ownership of resources, the fact that so much of these resources are being funneled out of the country, I think it's been a problem. And we don't have many doctors. Many of our doctors already work abroad because it's one of the professions people are attracted to, because it gives you some route out of the country, right? And many of the doctors who are working, we have, just in the last weeks, we've lost many doctors in this wave of COVID. And of course, the numbers don't look bad because there's so little testing already, right? So we don't know. I mean, so if you talk to most people, they say COVID is their least problem, actually, right now, you know. And so it has highlighted, I would say, these differences, but it has also, I would add, it has also exacerbated them, particularly when it comes to the effect of the effect on the poorest that rely on the informal market, which is the majority of the population, actually.
Freedom is meaningless unless propaganda, otherwise handicapped still survive. We'll show great gratitude to the leaders who ain't satisfied. This is what we want to see. Break the old shackle. This is what we want to see.
This is what we want to see.
Break the old shackle.
Come on, break them shackles. Come on, break them shackles.
Feroz had some questions for the panel, and amongst them, he brought up the issue of how Polisario had Morocco had broken the ceasefire that they had observed for quite a long time, and tried to get that included into the discussion around the regional resistance, popular resistance in the region.
Do you all believe that the current breakdown in the ceasefire between Polisario and Morocco is part of the second wave that accompanies the second wave, which has been described in this book? Yes, Sarah.
I mean, the coverage that I'm seeing of it is very much mainstream media coverage. So it's very hard to formulate a feeling about the current breakdown in the ceasefire. I know that Polisario is saying that it's withdrawing from the ceasefire. There's been a lot of movement there also in relation, in reaction by the Moroccan government. I think it opens up the possibilities. For me, one way in which it could become part of this wave is if it also manages to connect with some of the social movements within Morocco. So, for example, I've always felt that Morocco didn't get enough of a place within the first wave with the 20th of February movement that took place in 2011, and which the monarchy in Morocco managed to sort of masterfully diffuse that movement. But also, very interestingly, the Hirak movements, the Hirak that has been taking place in the Rif region of Morocco, in 2016 and 2017, especially, with really powerful movements that took place, which were met with a lot of a brutal response by the Moroccan regime. So it's difficult to see where this is going. But what is interesting, or at least what I'm looking for alternative and media on this, is to see what is, because the way it's reported in the international media is very much about the Polisario and the regime and the Moroccan regime, rather than to understand how this plays into the social movement dynamics more broadly, but also whether they are able to connect with these social movements within Morocco, which have been flaring up and bubbling up under the surface for the last 10 years, actually, since the first wave. And so I guess that's not really a full answer, but it's right. Something right. In relation to this.
I can give some elements of understanding that. We can't understand why there is a break of the ceasefire also if we don't get to know that these kind of I would say conflicts that are happening are also deeply linked with the economic crisis and the effects of the COVID-19. Why am I saying that? Is that several little wars are re-erupting. They were there. Like, for example, the Artsakh conflict. It was always there for a long time. It's still an issue of territories, of self-determinations of the people living there. And so the Polisario issue is also re-erupting, but the conflict was still there, because like the Sahrawi people have been colonized by the Moroccan regime and are trying to resist the same way that in a more radical way or different way than the Rif, because they want to achieve independence and they want their republic to be settled, while Morocco is denying their sovereignty. They're taking over the natural resources, and there is this fight for natural resources that is still happening. And so they are benefiting from the current crisis, and also for the lack of resources they are trying to grab on, like the Moroccan regime is trying to grab on more and more, the same way Israel does on Palestine, and the same way, in my opinion, like Azerbaijan is trying to do, to entrench one of the few places where resistance is. And also that's what they are doing to the to the Rif people, to the people, to Moroccan people in the Rif who are politically imprisoned. They are trying to move on, to move on their side, to make sure that there won't be any resistance against as well. So the question of the Polisario is still very tense, and it also raised diplomatic issues with Algeria, because Algeria is backing the Polisario movement, part for, I would say, geostrategical reasons, but also part of the history of supporting, I would say, like, oppressed nations, the same way they support, you know, the Palestinian people. You have this feeling of also supporting the people in Southern Sahara.
So the pieces that we've been airing for you tonight regarding the book of Region and Revolt, mapping the recent uprisings in North Africa and West Asia, this took place a few weeks ago. So vis-a-vis the whole discussion around Morocco, Western Sahara, and Polisario, there's a very important postscript, because over the last week or so, as one of President Trump's parting and devastating shots in exchange for Morocco normalizing its ties with Israel, Trump has promised U.S. recognition of Morocco's annexation of the Western Sahara. So this is the first country in the world to do this, obviously a major power that is doing this. It really throws a spanner in the works. You know, this is the Western Sahara has a UN recognized right to self-determination by its indigenous people, the Sahrawi, in the form of a referendum that for decades has been sabotaged by Morocco, and so consequently has yet to be held. However, there is still an international consensus that the Western Sahara does have a right to self-determination. The Sahrawi do have a right to self-determination through a referendum, and it is certainly not the prerogative of the United States to make that decision for them. But it is a very concerning development, and we actually will be lining up an interview shortly to take a more in-depth look at what is going on. And as Doug had pointed out, and as I was discussed with Feroz, the ceasefire that had, you know, been almost three decades long has fallen apart at Moroccan instigation, I would like to point out. And so this is something that we really want to delve into in greater detail in the next couple of weeks.
Well, that's it, ladies and gentlemen, for Amanda tonight. We are coming back to you next week with more news and analysis from the continent of Africa here at CKUT 90.3. We want to again thank the station staff for all they do to keep us going. And Gwen?
All I have to say is stay tuned for Jazz Euphorium. Africa Unite, Batsilele.
red alert. The spread of COVID-19 is at a critical level in your area or a neighboring region. Getting together with family or friends is prohibited, and traveling to other regions is not recommended. More targeted restrictions have been put into place to limit the spread and prevent a lockdown. Learn more at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Continue to wash your hands, keep a 2-meter distance, and wear a mask when physical distancing is impossible. We need to act now. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT, Henry Grimes. And stay tuned for more of the most aesthetic things, feelings in the world.